Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And Peter is definitely under the weather since he's been planting. You are a farmer,
I don't know about that. I'm an extraordinarily amateur horticulturalist who occasionally gets a few peppers and tomatoes to grow.
Yes.
And so we're hopeful for another year. And in any event, my back is broken, so it'll be a constant reminder that I put in the work. but this is a good segue in today's program because I planted all the things that we're familiar with. I planted peppers, I planted tomatoes, I planted a rather exotic thing called a ground cherry.
It's not real exotic.
But it's not really all that exotic, which is a good segue into the fact that today is a program all about exotic. It's about the exotic cuisine of countries like Thailand and the Yucatan part of Mexico, and it's about some interesting and not exactly your everyday ingredients.
Whatever.
Pulses from wherever and products from Turkey. So
yes.
We got a whole lot to talk about today, so why don't we just get on with it? And leading off is...
Oh, I mean, talk about a masterpiece is this book on Thailand, which comes with its own bag. It's a beautifully photographed book. But let's listen to Jean-Pierre Gabriel's discussion of it. This book arrived, Jean-Pierre Gabriel, Thailand, the Cookbook. And I couldn't believe it. It was such a gorgeously produced book. Also very heavy, I might add. Very big book. And I was not surprised that it took you 3 years to produce this.
Yeah.
But it's not just a cookbook. And it's not just a travel piece on a place in the universe. What was the purpose of this? You were rescuing a cuisine, were you not?
Yes. You know, when I talk with my Thai friends, they start to explain that recipe will disappear. Not only because they will lose the but also because all the environment will change. You know, one of the most impressive examples was when we arrived in Nen. Nen is N-E-N. It's a province northern Thailand, just a bit below Chiang Mai, known in the Lanna. We arrived there, and the car was, we just arrived in the province, and my team, they look to each other, and they say, have you seen? Changed so much. You know, 20 years before, this province was covered by forest.
Mm-hmm.
And today, there is no, at least, maybe you'll see one tree each kilometer, or mm-hmm. each mile.
Oh, dear.
And it's all fields, and everything has been devastated. And even in some parts, you know, when you're traveling at night, you see fires on the hills, and people are still keeping going on deforestation. If you don't have any more forest, you don't have any more the products of the forest. I speak about
it's like the Amazon.
But also the white leaves. They use a lot of white leaves, white plants. If you don't have any more this product, this ingredient, you cannot cook the same recipes.
Mm.
That's one point. Also, there was another point I am very sensitive about. It's the use of sugar. You know, in our countries, in the Western world, we are very aware about the use and the abuse of sugar, the normal diet. And what I have seen also, that there is also a change. They are using more and more sugar, even in the savory recipe.
Oh, that's a sad thing, because the cuisine has always been so helpful, hasn't it?
I remember we were doing a sort of omelette in a recipe with eggs, and it was a fried rice. I asked them, you know, really to explain me one more time how they do fried rice in the right way, when do you put the eggs, so it didn't need the rice to be hot or cold or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I was looking, you know, what she was doing, what the lady was doing. It was in a small village, one lady with two daughters doing a few recipes for us. And suddenly she had sugar. I say, why do you need sugar in this recipe? And I look at my assistant, my Thai assistant. I say, Kuntip, could you explain? And she said, no, I am not using sugar for this recipe normally. Slowly, mm-hmm. the people change. The taste change. And I believe that the taste change because they can buy more candies. They have 7-Eleven in every small city.
Oh, no.
So
awful.
They, And what you see that, it's sometimes even in, it's mostly, you can more understand that in Bangkok, you have a 7-Eleven. And on, you know, close to the shop, you have a lady doing on the hallway, young lady sometimes, or a boy, doing, for instance, a papaya salad on a traditional way. And you see the people buying this, a portion of this salad, but going inside the 7-Eleven, with respect for 7-Eleven, and buying candies, okay. Buying sweets,
oh my.
And soft drinks, a lot of, you know, so there is no, a mixture, of these two civilizations, of the modern way of consuming, of eating, of, and the traditional way. And
well, let's step back here. You were not Thai. You were Belgian.
Yes.
What put you in love with Thai food?
It's very easy. What I like in Thai food, first, it's very easy to cook. You know, for us, if you if I speak about you know, the pots, the soups, the stir fries. And mostly the stir fries, when you use using wok, it's very easy, and the sequence is very logical. So first you develop the flavors from your curry paste or from the garlic, from the shallot, and so on and so on. Then you start to cook the main ingredients, some vegetables or some fish or meat, and at the end you come with the final touch, which is gorgeous, the freshness of the herbs, you know, basil, coriander, cilantro, mint, spring onions, and so on. And this makes a fantastic mixture. Very fresh taste, very easy to eat.
And the flavor profile, everyone says, is hot, sour, sweet, and salty.
Yes, you have of course.
And yes.
Of course, but you know, the sweet side, you can, spicy, hot, spicy, that's everywhere in Thailand, always. And for instance, in the Northeast, it's for us, you know, as Westerners, worse than ever, and everywhere. Some recipes, if we were sticked on the traditional way of cooking, of the real way of the people cook in their village, sometimes even my Thai team, they were unable to eat the recipe because it was too spicy, too hot. But what is very nice in that you forget about that and you go to the normal way of using the bird eye chilies, of the chilies, of the dry chilies. But the nice point is what they can balance with the fish sauce, the soy sauce.
Oh, yeah,
and that gives you, it's really, you know, there's really flavor enhancers. That's not only for seasoning. They increase the way of you feel the taste in your mouth. And that's very something I find very interesting. Sweet taste depending on what you eat.
Right.
I am not very fan of this, of sugar and of sweets, but that's depending. When you have, for some palm sugar, that's fantastic because the taste is very complex. That gives you, other impression in mouth. What I like also, and it's sometimes more difficult, but it's the salt taste coming from tamarind, coming from even, you know, it's very easy. I don't know if people are used to do that, but if you make a fried rice and at the end, after, you add the herbs for 1 second and you take off the fire, and then you come with some lime juice, giving a bit of acidity, a bit of sourness, you know, all this complexity of, and also the fruitness of the fruit of this juice. And that's quite marvelous.
I mean, I knew there was diversity in Thailand, but nothing quite so devoted a number of essays at the front of the book to describing all of these different regions of mm-hmm. Thailand and the different styles of cuisine in each mm-hmm. of them. And you even note in the recipe where it's from. I don't know how, of course you have 500 recipes, but I don't know how you could cover that much diversity in one cookbook, and yet you did. How did mm-hmm. you collect these recipes?
So the idea was always we start over, I would say 60-70% of recipes come from local people. There were two types of local people. They were cooks, you know, people cooking at home and selling 1, 2, 3 dishes on the market, on the morning market of night market. So they subsistence from what they cook, but they know very well the recipes of their part of the country. And that was one part. Secondly, we contact with my team some families where they keep, you know, recipes and they keep traditional recipes. We work also with a few small restaurants, a very local restaurant, where we knew from, you know, we had a network. The strong point of this, in the making of this book, is that we had a network for the people in the Thai, my Thai friends and the Thai people working on the project. We had a very good network in the whole country. So they were calling, you know, I said, I would like to do that. I would like to find this sort of recipe. I would like, for instance, once I have seen a root called, it's a sort of ginger, very different, called black kwashai. And I say, okay, I have seen this ingredient, you know, on the market. I would like to have a look to recipes with black kwashai. So we went specially to Northeast, to Shanghai, just to see how they, you find that in your garden and how they prepare dishes with this root. At the end, I think we kept two recipes with black kwashai, no more. But yeah. I have seen 10 of them. Yeah, you know, I have tasted 10 of them.
You said you know, the first draft, you had 800 recipes, and you had to whittle it down to 500.
there were more because, you know, we had for 400 recipes, we had also, you know, all what the sort of mise en place, because in every, each village, we have a different curry paste. They make they have a different, so they have different points. So we had much more than 800. There was about 1,500 recipes in globally. So it's a lot. It's a lot. And we decided to come down to 500, you know, if I don't ask me. And also, you know, I would love to make a book where you have, for instance, I had so many recipes with hands. You have to be realistic. I am not sure that everybody is willing to eat ants, you know.
I was going to say you're very good about indicating substitutions, but I don't know where you get a substitution for a silkworm poo pie.
But you know, this book was also done. When you see the tourism in Thailand, there's a lot of people traveling to Thailand and touring in Thailand and going here and there in the country. And the idea of this book was also to collect some of the recipes that you can find on the market, on the market booths, on the street food booths, and so on. That was a bit also the idea, to open the eyes. And also, I have a good example. I love the young leaves. You will be maybe find me a bit crazy, but I love the taste, very fresh, a bit specific, of the young leaves of the cashew nut tree.
Uh-huh.
I knew that. You find the same tree in Brazil. On my side, the first time I say, why could we not find this sort of leaves, you know, in the Asian stores? So, anyway, about Brazil, I called Alex Atala.
We
know each other from years. Yeah. And I called Alex. I said, Alex, tell me, do you eat these leaves? He said, of course. So, what is interesting is that what we are used to eat, it's part of what we can eat, and everybody knows that. And part of these wild leaves, herbs, and so on, are also quite interesting to eat and to discover. And that was also part of this book, opening the eyes on some products that you cannot find.
Yeah, well, Alex, I have Alex's cookbook. He likes the ants, too.
Yes. But his ants are different because we went with Alex in Brazil and we worked on a few projects on ants and so on.
Uh-huh.
And his ants are different from the mine. His eggs are coming from the from Amazon, and as he said, it's a bit gingery taste and so on, a bit lemongrass taste.
Lemony,
you find this sort of taste also in ants in Thailand, but a bit different.
And also the ones that Rene Redzepi is crazy about, they're different also, aren't they?
Yeah. But, you know, also, just one example, very simple example, and there is a picture of this in the book. I have to find always the page. But I was, and also, you know, what I want to say also that is that, of course, you find a big Thai classic, the most important Thai classics in the book. It's not only, we are not only speaking about ants and very strange crickets, for instance, but I love...
Oh, yeah, you have a lot of crickets here.
Yeah, but I love to eat crickets, you know, deep-fried crickets. It's very good.
It's very good, but what put me off was the woman who said that she didn't like the fact that their little legs got stuck in her teeth.
I guess that's what dental floss is for.
So, you know, something more normal, you know. once I have been in the southern part of Thailand, I have asked, I would like to see how you make dried fish crackers, you know, before frying them or deep frying them and eat this sort of very good as snacks. And so we went to a small workshop, family workshop, to see how they prepare with, you know, fish flesh, with or shrimp flesh, with from rice and so on and so on and so on. Okay, and I asked to the lady who was there, do you have other specialties in this part of the country? Oh, yes, we have somebody is doing, and she gives me the Thai name, and of course, I didn't understand, and my team was not aware about what it was really, because in the southern part of Thailand I come to, it was about nutmeg. And in the northern part, they don't use a lot of nutmeg. They don't use a lot of nutmeg. So my team, have never seen this sort. And we came in a beautiful orchard with old trees, and an old man and an old lady, a couple, they were over the 80s, taking care of this, it's like Eden garden, you know, with mangosteen from a tree, from mangosteen tree for 400 years old, but really a dream. And I have seen for the first time in my life the fruit of the nutmeg. So when you see that,
really extraordinary, yeah.
Yeah, you have a picture in the book with this fruit, it's like apricot. Uh-huh. And inside you have the maize and exactly. And then nutmeg.
Yes.
But this guy, this old man, was doing candied flesh, candied nutmeg flesh. Mm-hmm. I bought this flesh. I came back here in Europe and I let that taste to some very good chef, and no one knew what it was. He said, "Oh, it's gingery. Oh, it's that. Oh, it's that." But this simple product, just you put the flesh, you put sugar, you let dry on the sun. Uh-huh. Under the sun. And it's a very good product. I was thinking to do, you make a crème anglaise, like to make vanilla ice cream, and instead of putting the vanilla pot, you put this, and you have maybe a nutmeg taste, a nutmeg ice cream that you can serve with some savory dishes. So this sort of thing I find also very interesting to look at and to try to find.
Well, you know, I want to mention also something. I don't want it to slip by without our mentioning it. You also have a really sterling array of guest chefs contributing recipes at the end of your book. I mean, I know Sailor's Thai in Sydney. And, of course, Kinshop. And Ian Kitakai, I think, is fabulous. Those are contemporary recipes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, and you have a glossary explaining a lot of the different things, and what else you have, you convey all the contributing cuisines, all the people whose influence contributed to Thai cuisine, which I didn't know either. I mean, it's encyclopedic. It's like an encyclopedia of Thai cuisine.
Oh, I would like maybe a day to make another one.
What will the next one be?
The next one?
What would go in the next one?
The thousand recipes you had to discard.
That's normal. Faidong is doing books, and very, very good books. I have a lot of respect for the team in London who has designed the book. They took care of what we have done and what I have done, and that was very, very. But you know, there is some frustration having all this picture of all these ingredients. And I am hoping that someday, maybe in the next future, we can put that, on internet, all these pictures, that people can have a look on it.
Oh, why not? I mean, you can do
that. I need to have, to ask Faidon, because I have respect for what they have done, and I don't want to play, my own, one-man show or my own game. But I think one day we have to show this, because it's, on a documentary point and an encyclopedic point, it's very interesting, very, very interesting.
Well, I think you've captured a great, great chunk of Thai culture, and keep going at it. I also was surprised that there's so many egg recipes. People will learn a great deal from this book, and I wish you a lot of success with it.
Thank you.
Yes. And I don't know what I'll cook out of it. I'm not sure about the big red ants or the crickets.
But they are, very, my kids now are eating Thai. My wife said to them, tonight we have fried rice. say, oh, no more. Again, five tries. Why?
Oh, dear. Well, you've really opened a whole new horizon for us, and I think anybody who gets this book will have the same reaction. And thank you for talking to us also, Jean-Pierre.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm guessing, like us, you'll not think of Thai cuisine and Thai restaurants in quite the same way ever again. And we'll be back with another exotic destination right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. As I said, to our next guest, David Sterling, his book called Yucatan really made me kind of nostalgic about a very exciting time I had in Yucatan. And I guess it's becoming a very popular destination now. And if you want a good introduction to the lay of the land and the food, get this book. Where to start, David Sterling? You are a man of many talents, and your book is multidimensional as well. It's called Yucatan, Recipes from a Culinary Expedition, and it has so many aspects to it. I don't know, as I said, where to start. You yourself are trained as a designer. You have an interest in architecture. You run a cooking school in Merida. What else can you tell us about yourself? You're obviously a talented writer as well, because your literary aspect of this book is extraordinary.
Thank you very much. Well, what more can I tell you about myself? I'm busy.
I would say.
I'm quite busy. The thing that interests me most about food, and I think there's a real trend in this now, is cultural context.
Sure.
Everyone wants to know nowadays where your food comes from. I haven't seen this episode of Portlandia on TV, but everyone tells me about it, that a couple is talking to the waiter in a restaurant, and they want to know where the chicken was
coming from,
and they get up and leave to go find the producer. Well, I think this is, it's hilarious. I have to look for that episode. But the fact is, many people, I think most of us now, are concerned where our food comes from, not just where, which farm produced it necessarily, but also where it comes from in time. How did I get this recipe? People share their grandmother's recipes. That's when you have a close connection to your food, is when you can tell a story about it, and when it's meaningful to you in a cultural and historical context. And that's how I wrote the book. Completely, I did a lot of research, as you can imagine,
having read it. Yes.
And a lot of my investigation took into the pueblos, where I learned from local ladies who taught me their recipes, but also I've discovered, luckily for me, a nice little treasure trove of some vintage cookbooks from the region.
Oh, wow.
And that was fascinating to see what things occurred when. For example, just one little anecdote, there was a cookbook published in 1832 about Yucatecan food, and at that time it was mostly Spanish recipes, because we were still just, actually this would have been just after the revolution and independence here,
mm-hmm.
but most of the foods were Spanish, like albóndigas and all sorts of stews that were Spanish. Finally, that book was updated in 1896, and at the back of the book, finally, they have some real Maya recipes, some truly old Maya recipes for tamales and things like that, that were sort of hidden, I suppose, until that time.
Now, you go to lengths to point out in your book that there is a distinct difference between Yucatan and Mexico.
Oh, yes, very distinct and vivid.
You can feel it when you're there, because I've been in both places.
Yeah. You feel it. In fact, funny, I wish I could have included this in my book, but it's something I just found. There's a local newspaper here called Por Esto, and it's kind of a rag. It's a bit of a scandal sheet, but their slogan, their tagline is identity, integrity and sovereignty.
Oh, sovereignty too. How hysterical.
Because I know, because, you know, at one point Yucatan, actually at two points, Yucatan was a sovereign republic. And every now and then political parties will bring that up as a, as their platform for their campaign. Well, it's interesting that the concept hasn't ever really died.
Yeah, wow.
We think some sense to succeed and be good enough on our own.
Geographically, I mean, you point out that at one point, actually, there was a disconnect when Yucatan was cut off from Mexico, was as an island.
Yeah, there was an interglacial era about, I think it was 80 million years ago, a long time ago, and these interglacial eras, they happen all the time. It's when the ice caps melt and the sea levels rise. It's happening now, and it happened, has happened many times in the past. These eras only last about 150,000 years, but in that time, this was enough time when Yucatan was cut off from the mainland Mexico that a lot of endemic species evolved here. And we still, they're still here now, species that are not extinct, some on the verge of extinction. But this all happened as a result of that time when we were an island. And then I also mentioned in the book, just an interesting side note, quite coincidentally, a Venetian cartographer was here in the, I think it was 1544, and he was, you know, making maps of this new world, and he drew Yucatan as an island as well. So we have this island separate mentality still to this day.
He wasn't a very good cartographer, I guess, right?
No, not particularly, but I suppose with the tools they had at their disposal at that time, maybe he wasn't too bad.
Now, let me ask a really dumb question, which I should have asked earlier on. Mérida is in Yucatan.
Yes, okay. Well, this is, it's not a dumb question, and I address that actually in my book. It can be confusing. Yucatan is a peninsula. It's also the name of a state, the state of Yucatan. There are three states in the peninsula of Yucatan, Campeche, Yucatan, and Quintana Roo, where Cancun is located. And so it can be confusing, and even here people sometimes lose track of which Yucatan they're talking about.
It's like Maya. They lose track of the difference between Maya and Mayan.
You still didn't answer my question. So Mérida,
Mérida
is on the Yucatan Peninsula.
I went off on a tangent. Mérida
No, not to worry.
Mérida is the capital of the state of Yucatan.
Okay.
It's also considered the cultural capital of the entire peninsula. People, I mean, it almost feels like regional capital because people come here to go to the doctor. People come here to buy their cars, actually. We have a lot of modern car dealerships, and people from Quintana Roo or Campeche will come here to purchase cars. It's like that. We have a wonderful concert hall here, huge, and we have our own opera and symphony orchestra, and so people come here to do that as well. So it feels in a way like the capital of the entire peninsula, although legally, politically, it's the capital of Yucatan State.
Now, you have a section, you have many interesting sections in this book, I must say. You had so many complex ideas that you broke them down into sections, actual physical sections. And the one I wanted you to explain is the one called How to Use This Book.
Oh, okay. Well, again, the thing that fascinates me most about food is the context in which we eat it or cook it. Where do we find that food? Where does it come from? So the book is written, all the sections that you mentioned are actually places that I take you to on a visit. As you see, the name is called Recipes from a Culinary Expedition. Right. I take you, the reader, on an expedition through Yucatan. We go to pueblos. We go to the three main cities. We go to the shoreline, which is vast, and we collect seafood recipes there. And then we do the people's food, as I call it, where I take you to bakeries and shops that produce lard, which are called chicharronerías, and other sections like the cantina as well, which is one of my favorites. So because of that, because I take you to the context in which the food happens, the book is not organized in traditional recipe or cookbook format, such as appetizers, main courses and such as that. So I wrote the section called How to Use This Book for that reason, that it tells you, in general terms, it says all of our cocktail appetizers can be found in these sections and so on. That's how why that section was written. But for those who might get a bit lost, we've written a wonderful roadmap for you at the back of the book, which is an index to recipes. And there things are organized in the traditional way. You can look up party foods, and if you have, let's say, I mean, I think most people cook this way. I have some pork chops in the fridge. What can I do with them? So you look up pork, and it's very easy to use in that sense.
Now, what I wasn't, I mean, I'm aware that it's sort of a corridor country, but I was not aware of the extent of influences that have been absorbed into the culture and therefore into the cuisine of Yucatan, including Lebanese.
Yes, Lebanese. Well, it's interesting because if you look at a map, a lot of things become immediately apparent. First of all, we're much closer to the Caribbean islands than we are to the rest of Mexico. Much closer.
Yes.
So the earliest influences came from the Caribbean. The Mayas, it's been documented rather recently, actually, were the first inhabitants of the Antilles. They have recently found lithic remains of the Mayas in Havana. So that influence happened early, early on. Later, the Carib Indians, as they're known, came up from South America and settled in the Antilles. And there was much interchange between the Mayas and those Indians of the Antilles. And we get a lot of our words from the Arawak and Taino languages. For example, canoe, hammock, hurricane, and many, many others. And food-wise, we have barbecue, barbacoa, or barbacoa, I think it was pronounced, as an Arawak word that the Spanish heard as barbacoa, and then that became barbecue in our language. So that's beginning at the earliest times. Later, the Spanish came. The fascinating thing to me about the Spanish is that all of the influences, virtually all of them, that they brought over with them were Moorish.
That's true of Peru, too.
The Iberian Peninsula, the lower two-thirds of it, had been occupied by the Moors for about 800 years. So those first Spanish that came, literally, this is on the ship logs of Columbus in his first voyage in 1492, first American voyage, they had in their holds of the three ships garbanzo beans, lentils, raisins, capers, and olives, all these things that we so identify
and sugar cane, sugar.
Yeah, sugar cane.
Explaining this enormous sweet tooth. Yeah. You have a whole section on sweets.
Oh, yes. No, that was totally Moorish as well. It's fascinating. The Portuguese came, and our legacy of theirs is the longaniza, a wonderful smoked sausage.
Oh, yeah.
The Lebanese did come. They came later, end of the 19th century, early 20th century, because there was essentially a pogrom happening in the Levant. The Ottoman Empire was acting up. So Christians and Jews started fleeing by the thousands. They went all over the world, but huge numbers came to Mexico, entering in the ports of Tampico, Veracruz, and Progreso here in Yucatan. Some went into central Mexico. Many, many stayed in Yucatan. We have a very large Lebanese population here. So on the streets, it's very common to see just regular vendors like a Maya man selling kibis, which are those Lebanese fritter. You'll see Maya women in the markets all in their embroidered ipiles,
right.
That's the name of their dresses, selling bulgur wheat, which is for the kibis. And they call it trigo para kibis, wheat for kibis. It's hilarious.
Here's
unexpected.
Here's what you have to explain now, David, is you didn't come from Lebanon. We're not exactly sure where you started, but you were at least at some time in northern Michigan. So who chased you to Yucatan?
Yeah, well, born in Oklahoma. I lived there 25 years. It's curious because Rick Bayless and I are from the same town.
Oh, really?
We went to the same university, Oklahoma City University, although he was 2 years behind me, so we didn't know each other. And then we found out later that we both went to graduate school in Michigan. So we have all these things and that's what happened to me. After 25 years and getting an undergraduate degree in fine art in Oklahoma City, I moved to Michigan where I went to graduate school in design at Cranbrook. And then after 2 years there, I moved to New York and lived there another 25 years. Don't get out your calculators. So I lived there 25 years and then came here. It's a very long and convoluted story how I came here, but to shortcut it, I lived very near the World Trade Center on 9/11. I came down here to visit a friend in December after that happened, to just get away and chill out. She linked me up with a realtor, even though I hadn't expressed no interest in purchasing property here whatsoever. But within 2 months, literally in February, Valentine's Day of 2002, just a few months after the attacks, I bought a house here, thinking I would use it as a retirement place or an investment, maybe to sell and make a profit or something. I didn't really know what I was going to do. But after 14 months of coming down here to supervise the renovation, I fell more and more in love with it each time. And just eventually decided just to pack it in and move down here because it's a tropical paradise. How could you resist?
Exactly.
But then a cooking school?
Yeah, and then I started the cooking school. That's another convoluted story that I'll shortcut. My business partner in New York, both of us had quite a strong food background. He had worked in gourmet food stores, and as designers, we both did a lot of work in the food industry. We did restaurant logos, we did food packaging, and so on. And so at one point we decided, when I'm kind of toying with the idea of moving to Mexico, we had this idea of creating a line of gourmet Mexican food products, which we started and indeed did, and the line continues, although it's very, very small at this point. But I came down here and thinking that this would be a great place to live and also to be closer, have closer access to the ingredients that I would be sourcing, all of which was true. But meanwhile, I had the idea, the brilliant idea of starting a school that would serve synergistically to kind of work with the product line. Each could promote the other, if you see what I mean. Meanwhile, the school was so popular, it started in 2003, that December of 2003, just a few months after I actually moved here, it became so popular that I became too busy, and so the product line kind of got neglected, although, as I said, it continues in a very small form. We're packaging some local Yucatecan products. And those get sold really pretty much exclusively to people who live here and to the students that come to the school.
They're Mexican students, or they?
No, actually, it's funny that you ask that, because just the other day, after 11 years of doing this, after having 450 students on average every year, the other day, last Wednesday, I had my first Yucatecan student I was talking with him about it. I think it's kind of interesting answer. I think that younger people here, in their 20s, even maybe their 30s, to them Yucatecan food is what abuela makes, what grandmother makes. They want the sushi, they want the pizza, the Italian food and all that. They'll have the Yucatecan food on weekends when they go home. And then the older generation, many of them don't speak English. My classes are held in English. And also, I think simply they take their food for granted. They don't, in fact, with this new book, everyone is so surprised, very proud, but shocked and surprised that anyone would be so interested in their regional cuisine and write such a big book about it.
Well, I think it's one of the most interesting regional cuisines I've ever encountered. And I just wanted to give one example of, because we've been talking about the structure of the book and the philosophy of the book and so forth and so on. But it's filled, absolutely jam-packed, filled with interesting recipes, delicious, interesting recipes. And I just opened the book casually to this one. I wondered if you could briefly walk us through it. The langosta en relleno negro.
Oh, my goodness. Ugh. This is one of my favorites in the book. I'm so glad you stumbled upon that one. Well, it was just such a fascinating discovery. Okay, a little backstory. We have a recipe, a traditional old Maya recipe that is known as pavo en relleno negro. Now, this is turkey with a meatloaf stuffing. The meatloaf is colored and flavored with our recado negro. It is a seasoning blend made of charred chiles. The meat becomes black. The meatloaf becomes black because of this seasoning blend. Also, the turkey is stewed in its own, in a caldo, in a stock that's colored also and flavored with this charred chile paste. Okay, so this is a traditional dish that goes back hundreds of years, if not thousands, because turkeys are native to here. So now I'm traveling around in the port, along the shore, in the beach towns and so on, all around the extensive coastline of Yucatan, and we go to a little fishing village called San Felipe, which is charming and just an amazing. There's some great photos of it in the book. And I meet a woman there who is specializing in a dish which we later calculated to be about 120 years old, because it dates back to her great-grandmother, that she called langosta in Reino Negro. So instead of now the turkey, she switches to lobster. Her family is a fishing family, and that I just happened to luck out and be there in lobster season, wow, which was lovely for me. And so she makes it in basically the same way. The lobster meat of the tails is mashed up. I mean, she used a food processor and mixed with these, with this black chili paste, charred chili paste, and, then stuffed back into the shells and stewed in fish stock with more of the black chili paste. And I mean, it was exquisite. It's a little hard to explain if you're not familiar with this taste, but this charred chili taste is very, very Mexican tasting, or I should say Yucatecan tasting.
Yeah. Well, David, could I make a date to come down to visit you and have some of that?
You absolutely can. Oh, my goodness. And I would happily make it for you, because I, now that you've mentioned it, my mouth is watering and I want to eat some.
Yeah, me too.
And when is lobster season?
Yeah, when do we come?
Well, soon. August, actually. August is lobster season here.
That's going to be a little hot, though, in Yucatan.
Well, it is a bit hot there. But you know what? Actually, right now, we're in the hottest period now, April and May. It cools off to about 95 in August.
My guess is you're never coming back. So we thank you for this dispatch from Yucatan in the size of a small slab.
By brick, as you called it.
It's been a delight to talk to you. I wouldn't be surprised if there's a sequel in there somewhere. You can never tell.
You never know.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot for the opportunity of talking to you. It's been a pleasure.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Our next guest is one sharp, very sharp, businesswoman, entrepreneur, Esha Ray, founder and CEO of NRAY, and her first company, True Roots. We're going to be talking about both of these now. We're talking to Esha Ray. Did I do that one right?
Yeah, you did. You got the name right.
Please. Founder and CEO of NRAY, which I guess is the holding company for True Roots.
That's right.
And, yes, it's a very complicated situation. Your products aren't complicated, but the structure of your business has become even more complicated with your purchase by the Schmucker Corporation.
Schmucker, yeah.
And you were involved with a foundation?
Correct.
Okay. And let's start with saying True Roots is the company that produces blank, blank, blank. Can you fill in the blanks?
Sure. So True Roots is actually an innovative company that started out as a grain company and evolved into grain and grain-based products. So we do unique grains from around the world that have a story that actually connect to the farms that they come from, and we then clean them and pack them in the United States to bring them to the highest food safety standards. And we've continued to evolve as a company to provide more products under True Roots that are grain-based, gluten-free, clean-label products. So that includes sprouted grains, gluten-free pasta, which is an ancient grain pasta, cookies, pilafs, and the list continues to grow from there.
There are lots and lots of ancient grains, aren't there?
There absolutely are, yes.
I keep learning new ones. One of my favorites is Frika, which has an interesting story. And quinoa, they're apparently having a hard time fulfilling all the orders for quinoa. It's become so popular.
That's right.
Yeah. You specialize in sprouted products also, don't you?
That's correct.
Now, you explain in your packaging, but maybe you could explain for our listeners why it's more healthful having sprouted rather than not sprouted.
Sure. So, again, this kind of ties back into a wisdom from around the world, which is what True Roots is about. And it's also something that we were able to tie back into our growing up years in India. And sprouted grains is something that a lot of culture from Eastern civilizations, I guess Asian cultures, have always tapped into, because it is a better, kind of more healthier way to eat your grains. And what the process usually does is allows the seed to grow into a plant form, but you capture its best nutritional potential when it is in the sprout form. So it's a naturally occurring process, but through that process, there are enzymatic changes that occur in the grain that makes the complex carbs and proteins and fats in the grain become more simpler or pre-digested through the process of sprouting.
Now, that's interesting. Now, do you throw when you say sprout, it seems like I'm thinking of a little green shoot coming out. I mean, what do you do with those? Do you cut those off?
No. So you actually allow the grain to grow into that shoot form, but the shoot length is kind of key. The more you allow it to grow to a longer sprout length, what happens is that the grain starts to, the seed starts to use that for its own development or to turn into a plant. So it's important to optimize the sprout length to under a millimeter and then utilize that sprouted grain by dehydrating it. And that's kind of where we brought in a little more of a change, because people eat fresh sprouts all the time without worrying about the sprout length. But we're trying to maximize the nutrition potential of the grain by keeping a sprout length to the minimal, and allowing the nutritional benefits of the grain to be shelf-stable by dehydrating it. So that's the True Roots difference.
Okay,
so
so that's the difference. Somehow it seems a little bit unfair to the poor little quinoa seed.
What about the mung bean?
That it thinks it's going to go to be a plant, and it never really does.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. But it goes on to actually bigger, better things, which is provide great nutrition and,
okay,
and, you know, convenience to people.
Yeah, we had a friend who was doing sprouts. The company was Mung Dynasty, and he started out sprouting things in old bathtubs in a warehouse, which I think was a little bit problematic, because I guess that environment is really good for bacteria, right?
That's exactly right. And I think that's, again, how we specialize the technique of what we do under True Roots is we don't do fresh sprouts, which sometimes have shelf life issues and microbial growth issues. By dehydrating the sprout, we make it shelf stable for 12 months, but we also keep it food safe because the water activity is so low that nothing can grow at that level. And so the product's almost similar to a shelf-stable grain, which is the difference that True Roots offers under its sprouted grain.
Now, are the farmers who grow the grain, are they actually doing the sprouting for you, or do you take over before that happens?
Yeah, we actually bring in all the grains into our facility here in Livermore, California.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, and then do the sprouting after we clean the grains or color sort the grains.
Now, we interviewed someone just a few weeks ago who is making vodka out of quinoa.
Yeah.
And they're buying their quinoa in Bolivia. But one of the things they said their company stands for is fair trade. So they work to pay the Bolivian farmers cooperative from whom they buy. They get them the best prices they can afford to give them, and more than they would have, if you like, if they were just trying to market the grains themselves. Are you doing the same thing?
Yes. So actually, we definitely would like to call ourselves a very socially responsible company, and it's just NRA, to go into the history of it, we were the first company in the year 2000 and 2001 to make rice a fair trade item here in the U.S. So we've always believed in giving fair wages to the farmers, because that's actually, you know, where everything begins. With quinoa, we felt like there was a cleaner, kind of more meaningful way to give back to the communities, and that's how the NRA Foundation came into being. We developed a concept of defining projects with the help of the farmers that we work with. Nimish is my husband and co-founder in the company. We travel quite a bit to visit with our farmer groups and cooperatives to understand what they're going through, to understand their situation at the farm level, so that we can appreciate what they do and probably even help resolve situations each year with what we can give back through the foundation. So we've defined very many different projects with the help of an NGO that's based in Bolivia that helps implement those projects for us. And that has been our way of giving back to the farmer communities. The pricing with quinoa, as most people know, because of the demand supply situation, has continued to grow and kind of go up. So the farmers are definitely getting pretty fair wages because it's more of a seller's market, so to speak.
Well, how did you learn all this?
Just on the job, I guess, right? By traveling and talking to the people that grow and products. And both, again, both of us have really enjoyed traveling and exploring different cultures and foods and people. And so by being able to bring that into True Roots and our experiences that we learn from, we just kind of continue to apply and grow from there and learn new things each time we travel.
Now, by any standards, it would appear that you and your husband have been, shall we say, insanely successful. If I take one measure, which is that the J.J. Smucker Company thought enough of what you were doing that they wanted to buy the business. At the other end of the scale, if you like, my Whole Foods store, where I shop almost every day, which is about 10 minutes walk from my house, has many of your products on the shelf. I'm guessing that they're not an easy company to deal with, because they're bombarded with people with products that they're trying to bring to market. So congratulations on being so successful. Is there a secret?
Thank you. I think the secret is just being true to what you believe in and being passionate about it. Continue to build relationships both on the supply side and on the customer side, and always believe in being transparent and offering something that's high quality. Just continuing consistently to do so, I think, has helped us build some phenomenal relationships both for life and for work. And I think that's probably the success story for us.
Yeah, we have like six different kinds right now, I think, don't we, sweetheart?
Yeah, I want to know, we also got a shipment from somebody of canned snails. I was wondering if any of the grains would go with snails.
Well, there's no reason why not.
What about mung bean sprouts with snails?
Probably be very good, I should think.
And escargot butter, which would clog your arteries.
You remember Heston Blumenthal used to serve his snails in what he called snail porridge.
That's right.
Which is made out of oatmeal.
Yeah, how cute.
So maybe that's what we need.
Maybe we should do that.
I mean, but these snails are already dead. at least we hope they're dead. If not, they're not making very much noise swimming around in the can.
I wouldn't know much, because I've been raised a vegetarian, so I have never attempted to try a snail.
You mean a snail is non-vegan?
I'm sure snails are not vegan, not even close, I think.
Yeah. Well, Isha, I'm interested in seeing where you go from here, because you've developed a wonderful concept and you seem so well informed. So much going on. You said there's a lot of things of interest in your life.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, obviously, this has been a great platform, the J.M. Smucker acquisition for the company. I think our hope, as we made the decision to move the company over to them, the key reason was that we wanted everyone to have access to True Roots and the kind of products that True Roots would stand behind. And so I think the Smucker company, with its large distribution and setup, is well poised for that next level of growth for True Roots. So knowing that that first child is in good hands, I know that we're definitely going to start thinking of what else. And, I mean, the mindset of so many consumers now is changing. The way people make their choices as they pick up their foods every day has evolved so much over the last few years that we feel very, very grateful to be in this situation that we can continue to think outside the box and, you know, bring in that consumer that's going to listen to us and believe in it and try it. And so I'm just looking for that next step over the next few years, and I'm sure there's going to be something very exciting that we'll get to work on all over again.
I'm sure you'll be in touch with us. I wish you would make a note to do that when you figure out what it is. In the meantime, I think you only have one other challenge. You have to figure out an advertising program that's going to be as successful as Willard Scott recognizing centenarians for Smucker's jam.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to come up with a True Roots equivalent, so that I can hear you from time to time on the Today Show and be reminded about this delightful conversation that we've had today.
Oh, absolutely. I will definitely keep that in mind. I have to share with you a little story. Quinoa was a tough product to, you know, say for a lot of time. Like, people wouldn't be able to pronounce it when we started selling that product under True Roots, and there'd be a lot of questions around it. So it was interesting. I was talking about this to some of my friends, and they go, "Keen what?" And then they say, "Quinoa." So we actually made some T-shirts recently that say "Keen What?" and then it says "Roots Quinoa" in the back. So I know there's going to be plenty of quirky little things that'll go with True Roots that'll make it interesting as an advertising platform for Smuckers. And I know they have a talented team to back it up. So,
boy, if you have any of those T-shirts, fire a couple of them our way. That'd be fun.
Oh, wow!
Absolutely, yeah. I'll definitely do so.
Thank you again, and hope to talk to you again, Isha.
And thank you so much. Thank you so much for sharing a truly inspiring story.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Anne. Thanks, Peter.
And perhaps the most interesting thing about this wonderful lady is what she's going to do next. What are they going to do for an encore? Because Smucker's bought their company last year. Anyway, we'll be back with the exotic delights of the country of Turkey right after the break, so don't go away.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
We're talking, actually, to Turkey. We're not talking Turkey. We're talking to Turkey, to Semir Bayraktur, who has a wonderful company called Nar Gourmet. Is that correct, Semir?
Yes, it's correct.
Now, how new is this company?
Actually, we started up Nar Gourmet in 2007. So we have been working for this project like more than 8 years. So, like 7 years, and in 2013 we started up Nar Gourmet Incorporation in the United States. Since our production facility based in Turkey, so that's why we first started up the production and everything in Turkey.
Well, now your products, Semir, are Mediterranean in style and scope, but they're very essentially also Turkish. They're from Turkey, and I was curious, since I've never been to Turkey, what is so specialized and particular to the terroir of Turkey?
Actually, you know, Nar Gourmet's product captures the essence of Turkey's, you know, Anatolian heartland, and also they're the reflection of a particular region of Mediterranean coast, which is one of the most ecological diverse growing region in the world. So the terroir of Turkey, the Mediterranean coast, is again the most ecologically diverse region. So we believe that every one of the product we produce should tell a story. You know, the each has distinctive evocation of climate, soil, geography, growing condition, harvest technique, and craftsmanship. So they all give specific insight to the terroir of the land and of the product.
Now, listeners, just get a picture of the Mediterranean area in your mind, and then think of the area that Samir is talking about as that long peninsula that sticks out between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean side across the sea from Cyprus. Am I describing that location correctly?
Okay.
Am I putting it in the right place?
Yes, it's the correct geography. Actually, Turkey is a place where Europe and Asia side connects to each other. You know, it's like the bridge between Europe, the Eastern Europe, and the Western Asia. And the Black Sea upper of the Turkey land, and the Mediterranean Sea down the Anatolia.
Now,
so it's correct.
Now, it's funny, let's just say this quickly and then we'll go right by it, but for many centuries, the connection between Turkey and Southeastern Europe wasn't exactly cordial. In fact, it was distinctly unfriendly.
You don't want her to translate that.
No, well, if you can just pass that along, and now we're dealing with a global situation that's a whole lot different, where Turkey is our ally after perhaps 1,000 years of not being so.
Yeah, that's probably.
I need to tell Samir a story. I once owned a Greek restaurant in Philadelphia, but to get the best food for our restaurant and the best chef, we hired someone from Istanbul.
Oh, okay, very nice. Actually, you know, we have so many Greek origin citizens, you know, living in Istanbul. So this area, especially Istanbul, is a very mixed city, cosmopolitan city. Like, it's very old, like from Byzantine time, from Ottoman time. So many different cultures have been living here.
Now, the idea of artisanal farming, if you like, and artisanal products, is a worldwide trend. But since the company was only founded in 2007, I'm guessing that this is a fairly new thing for Turkey.
This is totally not a new concept in Turkey, because, you know, as I said before, you know, Turkey has home to this kind of artisanal product, you know, ecological growth for centuries. So it's like a tradition in Turkey, like this area, like Mediterranean countries, Turkey, Greece, a part of Italy, part of Spain. We all produce and consume this kind of traditional product. And like, you know, as you said, you know, this kind of cuisine and this kind of culinary is very popular nowadays, like slow food movement, ecological growing is very popular. But this geography, Mediterranean coast, is a home of kind of production and tradition.
Next up, could Samir give us some idea of the range of products provided by NAR, and also talk to some of the individual characteristics of the various preserves, oils, and vinegars?
Sure. NAR's products are the most regional distinctive artisan foods, like from single estate and single variety olive oil, seasonal preserves and marmalades, all natural vinegars, and like organic spices. Those are like product line. Sure, actually, like for example, our olive oil, we all use early harvesting techniques for harvest, and we only use cold press, and we hand-picked olives, and the olives are, you know, from a single estate, and we only use the single variety of olive. It's not blended, it's just pure single variety of olive, and the result of this production is exceptional olive oil. So our preserves and marmalade, we use traditional techniques for our preserves. And we don't use any additives, no chemicals, no preservatives, no pectins, no corn syrup, just natural sugar. Use artisanal methods and the pure flavor of the freshest fruit harvested at the peak season. That's, you know, the some important point of our production and our products.
We are enjoying the lemon peel marmalade or preserve.
Oh, thank you. It's very, you know, traditional for the western part of Anatolia, and it's also very common of the, you know, Asian Greek islands.
Now, one product we've seen products from all over the world, as I'm sure you know, and I'm sure Samir knows we must have tried them. I have never before seen dried tomatoes.
I mean, the powder.
Oh, really? It's very unique product, yeah. And they are, you know, by the way, they are organic too.
Uh-huh.
Can you give a little more background or insight into the product, since it is, you know, so unique to Turkey and to NAR?
Sure. I mean, no, I can tell you something about olive oil too. The homeland of the olive tree is Anatolia, a Mediterranean agriculture heartland. The Anatolia have been home to olive growth for centuries, and also today. And Turkey has more than 100 different distinctive variety of olive. So we use only exceptional estate-grown olives and from all around Anatolia. That's why in Turkey we are one of the olive oil, more than 15 different variety of olive oil, like wine. When it comes to wine, you can speak about the Cabernet, you can speak about Merlot, Shiraz, and Chardonnay. So it's all varieties of grapes, and then it's really same in olives. So in Turkey, there are more than 100 different varieties of olive. So we use this Bounty and then 15 different varieties of olive oil from different regions. And the other important thing about Anatolia is the ecological diverse growing region. So we are very lucky to have seasonal fruits. So we use only seasonal fruits for making our jams and marmalades. We don't use frozen fruit for that. So we are very lucky to have this variety.
We have another class of product that I don't think we've might have mentioned, but we haven't talked about it so much, which is vinegar. Now, what's the base of the vinegars that are produced in Turkey that you're sending over here?
Maybe we should find out availability in the U.S.
Can you talk?
Yes,
can you talk?
Products are available in specialty stores throughout the United States and on Amazon.com.
Is there a website that people can go to find out more about the full range? Because there are so many different varieties.
Yes, nargourmet.com.
N-A-R with any punctuation
N-A-R,
between?
N-A-R, no, just nargourmet, nargourmet.com.
Right. Well, thank you so much for your patience. You want to try Nar and see if you still have them?
For vinegars, actually, you know, we also use different kind of fruits like mulberry, red wine, white wine, and apple. We also are working on different kind of vinegar products like pomegranate and mandarin.
Wow.
And so on. We use the natural methods of making vinegars, like, you know, just the fruit and water, that's it. And they all, you know, natural fermented vinegars, no added anything, like no chemical, no acidity regulator or whatever. So that the natural form of vinegar.
Well, they're delicious. The products are they seem so clean and fresh and pure. I just think they're going to be a huge hit.
Thank you very much. Actually, the other thing is, which is very nice, is the ecological growing is becoming very popular, and also agroturismo, like Italian said, culinary tourism, and, you know, agriculture tourism is becoming much more popular in Mediterranean coast. I hope one day, you know, Anne and Peter can come to Turkey and, you know, visit beautiful part of Anatolia and they, you know, experience the production techniques and the traditions in Turkey.
Well, Anne loves the idea of coming to Turkey, so we'll have to see if we can't make that happen. In the meantime, thank you so much for joining us today on the menu.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Yeah. Seth.
Pleasure. Thank you very much, Anna Peter.
Oh, thank you.
You are.
Thank
incredible.
You, guys, for.
Audrey, thank you very much for everything.
Thank
have
you.
Nice
thank
day.
You.
Who knows where On the Menu will take you next week? You'll have to join us again to find out. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.